You're listening to Red Eye on Co-op Radio at CFRO 102.7 FM.
British Columbia is giving away control of its rivers and streams. Dozens of private power plants now dot the province. Environmental safety can no longer be guaranteed. Neither can energy security, as much of this power is sent to the U.S. This surrender of autonomy is packaged as common economic sense. On the other side of Canada, they have discovered a different kind of common sense. The Newfoundland government recently took over the assets of a private paper mill. That mill had received generous perks from the province, but the owners had in turn laid off hundreds of workers. They had also continued to make a tidy profit exporting power to the U.S. Chris Arsenault is a journalist and author. He's been following this story, and he's joined me by phone. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Sean. How are you?
Good, thank you. Newfoundland Premier Danny Williams said that the mill operators had reneged on their commitment. What commitment was he talking about?
Well, this actually goes back to even before the founding of Newfoundland as a Canadian province. It dates back to a 1906 agreement. There was a company at that time, Abitibi Consolidated, later bought out the assets of that company. So the agreement from 1906 is really quite clear. It says that the company has the right to use and enjoy the province's forests and waterways for the purpose of creating pulp and paper, or for creating paper products. So it's basically a social contract between the company and the government saying, if you employ people, if you develop a town here in this rural, fairly isolated part of Newfoundland, then we will allow you to use timber and use the waterways to generate power to create that timber. So that was the agreement. What Danny Williams said on December 17th is, look, guys, you violated this agreement by no longer properly producing pulp and paper. If you're going to be laying off staff and not producing what you were said you were going to do, then you have no right to use the province's hydroelectric power to sell to other people. That wasn't the mandate which you were given. And the core politic behind the announcement is very simple. It's that natural resources don't belong to companies. They belong to the people. They're a collective good. And if companies aren't going to harness those in the collective good, then they have no right to them. And it's a pretty simple yet very scary statement from the ideas, or from the notion of Abitibi and other companies around the country who were terrified by this move.
And what kind of assets were seized exactly?
Well, I spoke to a senior person from Abitibi, and we're talking a number of buildings. We're talking the generating assets for hydroelectric systems. We're talking about a full pulp and paper mill. So Abitibi says these assets are worth at least $200 million. So this is not small potatoes. These are serious capital investments we're talking about here.
And how has Abitibi responded to this expropriation?
Well, they've come out guns blaring on this one. Basically, they're going to be launching challenges certainly before a NAFTA tribunal under the North American Free Trade Agreement, under Chapter 11, which is the so-called investor rights provision of the agreement, which has been very, very controversial. So they're going to be suing under NAFTA. They've been doing a public relations blitz, and they've been doing a major lobbying blitz on both sides of the border, interestingly. So they met with the U.S. ambassador to Canada. They met with Stockwell Day on this file. They met with a whole host of senior people in trade and foreign affairs, including at the cabinet level, to push their case. So they're going to be looking for at least $200 million from the government of Canada as a suit under NAFTA. So that's going ahead as we speak.
And if this case does go to mediation in NAFTA, what can we expect?
Well, NAFTA has, especially under Chapter 11, there's been one or two cases where the NAFTA tribunal, and those tribunals are made up of a trade bureaucrat from Canada, the U.S., and Mexico, and there's no real public oversight. So under those conditions, it's been very, very rare that I only found one case, actually, where a company was overruled in favor of a local community. And in that case, it was just so clear-cut that the company wasn't able to build a waste dump, and they had lost two appeals, and this was in Mexico, and there was just no way it was going ahead. But I don't. There was a couple of landmark cases on this in the last little while. In the Canadian context, the most notable was with the gasoline additive MMT. And that case happened in 1996. U.S.-based Ethyl Corp sued the Canadian government for $251 million because we banned the gasoline additive MMT, which is a known carcinogen and dangerous. So the company who produced that dangerous product sued the Canadian government. In July of 1998, the Canadian government folded like a house of cards and gave the company $19.5 million because they were worried they were going to lose the NAFTA lawsuit. A similar thing happened in Mexico in August of 2000, where a tribunal ordered the municipality of San Luis Potosí to pay out $16.7 million because local communities near San Luis Potosí had been protesting and doing their best to block the construction of a toxic waste dump by the U.S. company Metalclad. So if Chapter 11 is stopping individual communities from trying to pass legislation against things like hazardous waste dumps or dangerous gasoline additives, then it doesn't bode well for local democracy versus corporate control. I've spoken to a number of high-level trade lawyers about this. Generally, the voice from kind of the University of Toronto crowd is that Abitibi's case is considerably strong. I've spoken to a couple of other lawyers who think that if the government negotiates this properly, then they could win. The interesting divide on the legal matter is that it won't be Danny Williams or the government of Newfoundland who really deals with this case, because, as you know, international trade is a federal matter. So it's going to be the Harper Conservatives who have to defend this, which I kind of get a kick out of because they're so pro-business and so anti-Danny Williams that they're now going to have to clean up the little mess he made. So the question then becomes, will Stephen Harper negotiate this like and litigate this like he means it, or will he fold like Superman on laundry day and make an out-of-court settlement to the company? And if I was betting, I'd probably bet on the latter, but I'm not sure what's going to happen.
If the company is reimbursed for this, how much money are they looking to?
They're looking for at least $200 million, and that number could go as high as $300 million. So we're not talking about small potatoes here.
Okay, and what has been the reaction in Newfoundland to this move by Danny Williams?
Well, I think it's safe to say that Danny Williams is far and away the most popular premier of any Canadian province. I spoke to one gentleman who had worked at the mill for his whole life, and his point, and this has been echoed in call-in shows and around Newfoundland, is, look, I mean, this company was here to produce paper. They didn't produce paper. End of story. It's not that complicated. They aren't fulfilling their responsibilities. And, I mean, Williams' popularity is in the mid-70% range, which is very high for a provincial politician. So this move has been greeted happily, I think is very safe to say, enthusiastically, around Newfoundland, where people have definitely more of a sense than in other regions that outside corporate interests are not there to make their lives better, but they're there for their own bottom lines. And I think that historical tradition, coupled with Williams' own personal charisma, has made this a very popular move.
And Danny Williams has been nicknamed Danny Chavez. Obviously, that is a reference to Hugo Chavez, the Venezuelan president. Has Williams shown us a new way for governments in Canada to deal with unethical corporations?
I'd like to say yes, but You need to remember this, Sean. We don't know what's going to happen with the mill yet. The government's slated to take it over at the end of March. So, I mean, if that mill sits idle, if nobody's employed, and the government ends up having to pay a whole bunch of money to Abitibi for assets that, in my mind, aren't really worth that much. Like, I don't think the assets are actually worth $200 million, but that's what Abitibi is pushing for. So if taxpayers are on the hook for that cost, and the mill isn't reopened, then no, I don't think this is an alternative model at all. I think it would just be political blustering. If, however, Williams is able to reopen the mill in some capacity and get people back to work, then I think this is a tremendous victory for the people of Newfoundland, and it certainly would prove a model for what other jurisdictions could do. However, as I'm sure most of your listeners know, the forestry sector around the country is hurting badly right now. So it's going to be hard for Williams to turn that mill around and to get a viable business model going there. So I think, I think expropriation only works, or most radical actions only work when there's a viable alternative to fill in when the market leaves off. And I think that's what we're left wondering about right now. So I hope for the best, but I'm not overly optimistic, simply not because of anybody's fault, but just because of conditions in the international forestry products market.
Thank you very much, Chris.
Thank you very much.
I've been talking with Chris Arsenault. He's a journalist and author. His forthcoming book is entitled Blowback, A Canadian History of Agent Orange and the War at Home. It will be released by Fernwood Press in March. For more information on the paper mill seizure and other topics, you can check out Chris's articles at Interpress Services.